The Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129 presents America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Good day, you're listening to America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. I'm Carrie Weber, executive editor for America Magazine.
And I'm Father Eric Sundrup, and each week we offer news and analysis at the intersection of the church and the world gathered by the team here at America Magazine, and I'm filling in for Father Matt Malone today.
Indeed, and one of our wonderful team members at America is with us today, Olga Segura. Welcome to the show.
Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you.
Glad to have you. And in a little bit, we'll be joined by yet another member of our team, Michael O'Loughlin, who's our national correspondent, who will be talking with us a bit about the recent bishops' meeting in Baltimore, a bit about how their voting around sex abuse went or didn't happen, and a bit on the new pastoral letter on racism, which is the first in almost 40 years that the bishops have put out. And Olga has also covered that for our site, so she'll be sharing her thoughts as well. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Carrie. Good to be with you.
So I wonder if you can just briefly tell us a little bit about how everyone was feeling at this bishop's meeting in the midst of some of this chaos and what you observed there.
Yeah, I have to say, the meeting was really remarkable. People, lay Catholics, were expecting there'd be some sort of action on the sex abuse crisis because they were told in the week leading up to it that there would be. And I think bishops went in feeling energized, like they were ready to make some progress. And then on Monday morning, when Cardinal DiNardo made the announcement that the Vatican had asked them to hold off on any sort of vote, there was a kind of draining of energy from the room. You could tell that bishops were taken by surprise. Most of them found out at that announcement. A handful of U.S. cardinals who were in the room found out right before the announcement came. So really, everyone was kind of shocked by this. And you saw some for what counts as debate at a bishop's conference. Usually these things are very highly produced and people know what's going to be said. But there were some bishops who got up and said, we need to do something. Our Cardinal Soup, Bishop of Chicago, stood up right away and said we should take a non-binding vote if we can't vote on the actual proposals to show that we're serious about moving forward. Other bishops were more, I think, visibly upset. They were surprised that their work that had gone into these proposals wouldn't be adopted at this meeting. And it was kind of, I think, a disappointment to everyone, whether they supported the proposals or not, because after months of work, there'd be no tangible outcome from the meeting.
Yeah, and so what are some things that have come out of this meeting? What did they do? Did they vote in the non-binding way in the end? Did they have some level of discussion? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. Honestly, as a reporter covering it, the whole experience was kind of bizarre because you had these three or four different proposals related to sex abuse. And one of them would have established a lay review board to handle allegations of either abuse or mismanagement against bishops. Another would have established a hotline for lay people or priests to report allegations of abuse or mismanagement by bishops. A third managed what bishops who were removed from ministry over mismanagement, what penalties they would incur. And a final one that would have set sort of guidelines for bishops on how they're supposed to live out their call, their ordination as a bishop. And so you had this announcement Monday morning that there would be no vote, but they went ahead with the meeting anyway and sort of debated these different proposals, sort of the pros and cons, how they were created, different committees spent the last couple of months working on these things. And I think something that emerged for people who watch bishops closely, like I do, it's very unlikely these things would have passed even if there had been a vote. There was a high level of disagreement about the sort of strengths and weaknesses of each proposal. It was clear, I think, that there were a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, there literally were a lot of unanswered questions from bishops to the people who created the proposals about different changes that would be needed in church law, about how much money it would cost to fund things like this, about who would appoint board members, who would appoint review board members. It was just clear that some bishops I spoke to said that it seemed like the ideas were good. The thoughts behind them were motivated by a desire to do something right, but that they maybe hadn't spent enough time thinking through the logistics of creating would be a really substantial change. So in the end, you had bishops kind of talking about their desire to keep moving forward on the issue, but I think you had a lot of disappointment that there were no concrete steps, and different reform groups in the church certainly expressed their anger that, once again, Catholics are being told to be patient on this issue, something that's been going on for decades now.
Mike, a quick question. Do you think the bishops, by and large, are aware of the level of that anger and frustration among the faithful?
I think some are. Some that I spoke to certainly said that, you know, they were going home to dioceses where they would encounter faithful Catholics who were very angry about this. They seem to understand that they felt that they've only had a couple months to deal with this issue because it kind of broke open again this summer with the news of Cardinal McCarrick. But I think a lot of lay Catholics and reform groups, priests as well, say, actually, you've had 15, 20 years to deal with this. Why weren't bishops held accountable during the first round of revelations back in 2002? So I think some are certainly aware of the sort of level of anger from many Catholics. Others, though, I was a bit surprised. If anyone followed along and watched the live streaming of the interventions from bishops, there was a fair bit of defensiveness. There were a couple bishops who sort of blamed the media for stoking outrage and anger. There were some who seemed pretty frustrated that the work that the Catholic bishops did in the early 2000s to adopt this charter to protect young people, they thought that ordinary Catholics and the media maybe didn't appreciate the amount of work that went into that. And by most accounts, the church is a safer place for children than it ever has been in the past few decades. There is training for volunteers, training for priests, there's mechanisms to report abuse, and there are several instances today where abuse has occurred. It's been reported. They followed the procedures, and it seems to have worked. So I think you have some bishops who understand that Catholics are angry about bishops not being held accountable in the same way that priests and other church workers are. And those who think that there's still some sort of, if not conspiracy, at least outrage at the church that's driving this this story.
Huh. That's really interesting. I imagine that we would all benefit from having watched that live stream of the bishops' meeting, as you describe it. And I think
you'd have several hours.
I mean, because I think that when you think about a meeting like this, you think about it as any meeting, something that like, okay, what are we going to get out of this? What are our objectives? And not necessarily the real emotional aspects of it for everybody involved. It seems like the bishops' meeting is kind of a bureaucratic necessity, but in reality, that's where a lot of these pastoral needs get hammered out and where the agendas get set for how parish life and life for Catholics works in America. It can be pretty high stakes.
I'm intrigued because I think it is important, and I understand how some bishops would want to, you know, react to the policies and the implementation since the Boston Globe revelations in 2002 have done a great deal of good, and that took a lot of work, and that's a lot of effort, and it is laudable, and the church is a much, much safer place. But this outrage, as I understand it, is actually really quite different than that because it's directed at bishop accountability. It's holding themselves accountable as everyone else. And I'm surprised that I wonder how you don't recognize that or don't notice that. I wonder what categories you have to live in or places you have to be for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think a fair number of bishops do get it. Just some history. So the Bishops Conference in 2002 passes this called the Dallas Charter informally. It's a document to protect children and minors in the church. And it was fairly controversial at the time because some priests felt that it actually went too far in that when accusation was made that priests maybe didn't have as many rights to defend themselves as they should. This is the zero tolerance policy. But bishops said that that's what they wanted. The Vatican approved it. The Vatican actually made a change in church law specifically for the United States so that this very tough zero tolerance policy could be put in place. Now, the controversial part is bishops were mostly exempt from this. There's some bishops who say that actually we weren't because we agree to follow it, but it's voluntary. So this is now 15, 16 years later, we're dealing with the ramifications of this exemption for bishops. The issue is, if you kind of look at an org chart for how the church works, there's a bishop and he reports directly to the Pope. Now, obviously, that is completely unsustainable because in the United States alone, there's something like 350 bishops, and that's just one small part of the church. So the issue is, who is holding bishops accountable? Most of them see the Pope once every 5 years. It's not the maybe the most efficient way to kind of look at job review, performance review. So now this is what bishops are struggling with. How do we hold ourselves accountable? And I think what I've heard from a lot of different Catholic groups is, well, they haven't been able to figure this out in the last 20 years, so it's not a surprise they couldn't figure it out in 2 months. But like I said, you do have some bishops who kind of recognize this, that something has to be done. And I would say not all hope was lost when the announcement was made, because what the Vatican said was, hold off on voting on these until after a meeting in February, when the heads of bishop conferences from around the world will gather in Rome to meet with the Pope to hammer out this issue. So in a way, that kind of bought, I think, bishops time, but it also raised the stakes of that February meeting substantially.
No, and I think it's important to the that there's some feeling, and you mentioned the priests wondering about the zero tolerance policy. There's some discussion what happened to the concept of mercy in all of this, and so there's a back and forth there, and I think there's some pushback too on proposals and policy about, you know. And this is, I think, is actually a very hard pill for the church in the U.S. or Americans to swallow, the concept of mercy and forgiveness in light of all of this abuse. And where does that work in, and what does that mean without using that as a cover for not actually dealing with the problems in it? So I think that's a very interesting topic. It was in there before, but it's been talked about even more after this intervention as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and another interesting part of all this, and there's some truth to it, is a lot of these cases are historical now. So the Pennsylvania grand jury report, which I think rightly angered so many Catholics this summer, these are cases that happened decades and decades ago. In many instances, the abuser has passed away. The bishop who mishandled the case or allegedly mishandled the case is retired, or he's passed away as well. So in a way, I think there's a challenge in how do bishops today, especially younger ones who, weren't around when these cases were alleged to have been committed, how do they sort of pastorally handle this anger at these historical cases, while at the same time ensuring that there's a process in place that this kind of thing doesn't happen again? I have to say, if there was a single bright light during an otherwise depressing meeting, this was it. You had a long-anticipated vote on this letter, discussion of which has gone back a couple of years. The church felt, bishops felt they needed to say something about what they see as kind of increased racial tensions in the United States. The discussion itself was really positive. You had a lot of bishops from different parts of the country sort of standing up and thanking the committee for its work. It was probably unfortunate that the vote came during this meeting, because obviously the attention was on other matters, and I think the bishop's energy was largely on other matters too. But I think one of the more interesting questions came from Bishop Chris Coyne of Vermont, who is or was previously the head of the Bishop's Communications Committee. And he wanted to know, like, how bishops plan to get this message out there, because there's this great content, and I know Olga can speak to that. She's read it much more closely than I have, this rather lengthy document. There's this great content, but how do we get people, Catholics, to read it and understand what bishops are asking? And it sounded like there was a bit of a plan. There's some educational materials that will be aimed for kids in Catholic schools, religious ed programs. But I think his challenge was, how do we get this story into newspapers, in front of people on TV, the internet? So I'll be curious to see how they go about promoting this meaningful, if somewhat controversial, letter.
Yeah, Mike, I think you mentioned there's a lot of content in there, and, you know, they give Catholics practical steps that they think people can take, including acknowledging our own complicity, educating ourselves, and even forming small groups where people enter into dialogue and really challenge one another to think about race. And they include a definition on racism, which is very similar to the 1979 letter. One of the biggest differences I found was that in this one, Native Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics get their own section, whereas in the letter, the one they published 39 years ago, kind of put these groups all together. But I'm interested, Mike. What has been the response that you've seen from Catholics, lay people who have kind of read this letter? Because I know the feedback I've gotten, but I'm interested in seeing what the feedback has been on your end.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'd say it's been fairly muted. I think the unfortunate timing of when the letter came out really hurt its chances of getting in front of people. You know, something I found interesting was there was this divide among the bishops, still, I think, about acknowledging what is racist and what's not. In the article that Olga and I, that we wrote together, I talked about how in the amendment process, this all takes place before the actual meeting, but they show you sort of different proposals to the document. There was a bishop from Little Rock, Arkansas, who suggested that bishops explicitly condemn signs of hate. And he included in that swastikas, nooses, and the Confederate flag. And there was some pushback from the drafting committee from a specific bishop, I don't think he was named, who said, well, actually, the Confederate flag for many is a sign of Southern heritage, so let's leave that off. And that, to me, showed that there's certainly agreement about condemning racism among U.S. bishops, but there's still the cultural issues that kind of permeate our society, you know, make their way into this body of men as well.
I don't know if it's like morbidly fascinated by the concept that clearly recognizes a sign of a hatred, the Confederate flag. They're not going to name that, and they're going to claim, well, because some people still see the sign of heritage. Are we not supposed to challenge people, myself, all of us included, whose heritage includes racism and hatred? Like that, I'm fascinated that the committee would let that through. I'm just amazed at that discussion. Could you read the room during when you know that was proposed?
Yeah, I mean, it's so these things. I probably didn't explain it well. Basically, you have the work on this document that goes on behind the scenes, and then bishops can submit sort of written questions or comments or suggested edits. The committee reviews them, gives a written response back, and then it's all passed out in this big packet of papers. So there's not sort of a verbal dialogue about these questions. This was, here's our document, do you accept it or not? And it was overwhelmingly accepted, with a handful of people voting against it, which we don't know why, because it's a secret vote, but at least we can say that an overwhelming number of bishops accepted this new letter.
Yeah. No, and Olga and Mike, you both talked about there's an overwhelming amount of positive things that are going to come out of it. I don't want to like just destroy it on a couple key points, which I think it should be critiqued on, though. But what do you think are the biggest positive takeaways?
Honestly, I think right now in 2018, when we have so many people who are our political leaders and people in various different organizations spewing a lot of racism and xenophobia, I think it is very encouraging to see the bishops publish this. And I think it's an encouraging example to set forward for Catholics. But I am hesitant to say that it is the best thing that they could have done. I think, you know, Mike mentioned, I know everyone is kind of thinking, stuck on this whole like, oh, they didn't include the Confederate flag thing. To me, I'm more disappointed in the fact that there wasn't even a distinction made between racism and prejudice. And I think I would have preferred bishops to say, you know, they define racism as something that all Catholics are capable of, which is wrong. You know, racism is systemic. It's institutional. We would have benefited more from having them call out white Catholics and say, hey, here is how you need to acknowledge your privilege. Here's how you need to acknowledge how you guys have been complicit. And I think that Catholics of color would have been more encouraged if that is what the letter had said. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who are just extremely disappointed in bishops, and they wish that they would have been stronger in this letter.
I wonder if what COIN's asking for that then could be an opportunity to do that, to, you know, in the rollout of the discussion of this, then to call out white Catholics and name racism as a systemic that you would be part of simply by being part of one group. That could be, it would, I know from discussions I've had in parishes that will generate a lot of heat, but I think it could be a wonderful place of beginning some reconciliation.
Yeah, I think ideally this is moving us toward some form of reconciliation, right? Not that it's going to be, you know, even achievable in our lifetime, but we're working on it, and it's something concrete that I guess serves as a jumping off point. You know, I think in that sense, I don't know, I think in that sense it furthers the conversation a little bit, even if it doesn't quite get us to where we need to be. I mean, do you think that a document is a useful way to do that? I mean, or is the, you know, who's, I guess I feel a little bit like, are enough people going to read this? I'm glad that it is there. I'm glad that it's a statement. Can they do something? What else can we be doing?
Well, I think one of the things that's so, when you're dealing with an institution like the church or any like large institution with a lot of things going on, to have a document that's authoritative in some way like this then gives local actors the ability to do some of the things, Olga, that I think rightly you're saying need to happen. And you have something to back, you know, I'm not just, this is just not my pet project, but this is in fact something that we need to get moving on. And here's the basis of some of this. And now let's take it a couple steps further and move on that. Because a question I have is a beginning an awareness of our complicity in the sins of racism throughout the past in the history of the United States and the institution of the church. I've not read it super closely. I know you and Mike have gone through this. Were there mentions of the slaveholding of Catholic institutions or dioceses or religious? I'm a Jesuit. The Jesuit, you know, were implicated in that. Were those mentioned in the document?
They definitely acknowledge America's history of owning slaves. And that's another concern that a lot of people have. There's no explicit criticisms of, you know, the Jesuits or people in government or just there's none of that. And I think that's what's been most frustrating for a lot of people. But I think, Harry, I think you're right. I think even with my own frustrations, I think it's a great starting point because I think it's important that they wrote this document, but my concern is how are we going to implement it, you know? How are we going to bring it to parishes? How are we going to get people to read it? Because not everyone's going to want to read this 32-page document on race, you know?
Well, I think the good thing I hope that it helps recognize is that the church is a diverse place, right? That there are Black Catholics, there are Latino Catholics, there are all sorts of every background of Catholics, and that everyone has a right to be in this church and everyone has a right to their voice in this church. And it matters, I think, to sort of see people like yourself in the church, even as we appreciate that diversity. So in that name, they advanced the saint cause for sainthood of Sister Thea Bowman, who was the first African-American religious sister from Canton, Mississippi, the first to head an office of intercultural awareness. And she was the first African-American woman to address the USCCB. So I think it helps in holding up these examples of people who have been faithful Catholics, despite, in a lot of cases, the church as an institution being really terrible to them through the church's own history of racism. So, Mike, was that a sort of a, I imagine that was a positive conversation around Thea Bowman. We have 2 minutes.
Yeah, no, it was. I should have said that was another sort of uplifting moment. Especially, I think, because a lot of people are unaware of this person. And so this is kind of an example of the bishop kind of deciding to have this conversation, to have this vote, puts her name in the news. And if people are interested, they'll read about her. And it does show an example of someone who stayed in an institution that is sometimes hostile to people of color and kind of did her job and is now being recognized for that. I think that's the kind of thing where you can hold up models of people. Cardinal Sean O'Malley kind of gave a nice shout out to Sister Bowman, talking about how people he ministered with in the Virgin Islands when he was a bishop there really revere her. So that was another moment, I think, that dovetailed nicely with this letter.
Yeah, I think, and hopefully, as you said, it'll spur people to learn more about her, to learn more about the lives that are examples to us, and also, the, as we mentioned, the church's own history of sinfulness. So hopefully you can find out more about this on our own website at americamagazine.org/serious. I'm Carrie Weber for Father Eric Sundrup and Olga Segura. Thanks very much for listening, and have a great day.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.